Well, hello, faithful On The Time Last listeners and new listeners to this film podcast, Doctor Who podcast, mix-up, mash-up, I think the young people call it, on the On The Time Last Film Club.
They don't.
They don't call it that anymore, do they not?
I've never heard young people. Not that I communicate too often with young people.
I am Mark Donaldson. I'm joined by Ben Burr.
Hiya.
And we're here, well, to talk about Dalek's Invasion of Earth, 2150 AD. But we've not watched it yet.
We're
about to watch it in a lovely cinema here at the National Film and TV School, which is on the site of the old Beaconsfield Studios. Now, Beaconsfield Studios produced quite a lot of films back in the sort of from the 20s to about the mid 60s. Mm-hmm. And what's most interesting for Doctor Who fans, one of the films that was filmed here in 1963 was This Sporting Life, which is obviously the film that got William Hartnell the role of Doctor Who.
Oh, really?
Was filmed in these in the studios here at Beaconsfield.
Okay. I mean, we've all heard of Pinewood, we've all heard of Shepperton, we've all heard of Ealing. I've never heard of Beaconsfield.
Yeah, I mean, they were, during the war, it was a, basically, they filmed a lot of the propaganda films here.
Right, okay.
And in the 20s, I think it was British Lion Studios that made a lot of the quota quickies, which was this kind of thing where there was like a set amount of films that we had to make in Britain. So they were kind of just churning these things out.
Sure.
So originally what
like
I was...
All your Will Hay comedies.
Yeah,
for
that,
Sunday
stuff
afternoon,
like that.
That type of thing.
Actually, The Long Arm of the Law, featuring Bernard Cribbins, who we will obviously be discussing later on, was also filmed. The studio stuff was filmed here as well.
With Peter Sellers. Barbara Windsor was in that.
Was she?
The Long Arm of the Law, I'm thinking of that Clach Crupton Cloister.
Oh, right.
Right, okay, sorry. Yes, you're right, Peter Sellers was in Long Arm of the Law.
Long Arm of the Law was filmed here as well. So actually, originally when I proposed the On The Time Last Film Club, we were going to start with This Sporting Life, because I thought it would be quite a nice one. However, it's 50 years, as this goes out, as you're listening to it, of the release, the UK release of Dalek's Invasion Earth, 2150 AD.
Yes.
So that's kind of supplanted our original plan. We're going to do this first.
Yep.
But we will talk, well, we will watch This Sporting Life and talk about that, I think, in the next episode. I think it's only right that we do that in the very area in which it was filmed.
Yeah.
William Hartnell has walked, not in this cinema is quite new, but William Hartnell has walked
The lengths that we have gone through.
The journey that we did to get here.
I must say as well, just before we do start watching it, regular listeners to On The Time Lash, we will individually watch each episode.
Yes.
Getting pissed in our own rooms and our own timetables.
Yes.
watching it. But this is completely different. This is a considerably big plush theatre.
Yes, it's about 150, I think.
We've probably got a film festival vibe to this. We'll take some photographs and put them up on Facebook and Twitter and the website. There's a really nice vibe, a nice different feel to this spin-off.
And also, rather than have us... I've got some notes just about the history of the film, but rather than us kind of having our meticulously... you've listened to On The Timeless, you know it's not that meticulous.
Yeah.
But rather than us have notes, you're going to have our initial reactions. Obviously, Ben and I have seen the film before, but we've never seen it the way it was intended, which is on a big screen, in a cinema, which, you know, I feel adds a completely different dimension to films.
Presumably one of the things we'll talk about is that this was how it was supposed to be seen.
Yeah,
huge
absolutely.
Screen... in colour, not on a tiny screen in black and white in the centre of a family room.
Which is what
room.
Doctor Who was in those days.
Yeah.
Really looking forward to it. We will join you. You will join us, however you want to do that, after the film.
Yep.
So turn your phones off. No talking. And please enjoy the film.
Yep. We're now going to edit in an hour and a half of silence.
Yeah.
So if you want to fast forward.
With the background noise of the film. And, just to give you that experience.
I'm looking forward to this. Let the
viewing commence.
I don't want to say let's press play.
No. I'll just turn the our On The Time Lash projectionist and we'll get him to start up the projector.
It's Kev. This is how we're getting Kev McCulloch in. He's our projectionist.
He must have pulled open the door just as I demagnetised it. He's got a terrible bump on his head.
Oh, nothing that a little fresh air won't cure. Fancy what's going on outside.
Hey, police! Hey, stop them! They're getting away!
You'll just have to come with us, that's all.
Hey, police!
What's going on here, then?
Smash and grab!
Oh, what, another one? It's always happening around here.
What I always like to do after I watch the film, sit in a pub and just chat afterwards.
And work out why we didn't like it.
Yeah, or why we did like it, or why we were at least glad of the experience.
Wait, that's setting the tone wrong. That's,
yes, no, because...
Yes, that was good, I enjoyed that. That was a great experience.
It was really good fun, wasn't it? Like, I think, like what I was saying in the little preamble, or ramble, you know, it is a different experience watching something, because, you know, I've only ever watched these films on VHS
or on
Channel 4
Movie Mix Channel 258 or something, you know, like some dreadful.
Are they the channel that have the rights to it now, because the rights seem to just punt about?
There's some absolutely bizarre little movie channels Freeview and cable and all that kind of stuff, and they very recently have been playing the Dalek films on a cycle.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, they're on there almost as much as The Big Bang Theory is on E4.
Because we watched it from a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Through a proper cinema projector.
Yes.
It's a really lovely restoration they've done on it, because it's still... We had a talk recently from somebody who, you know, specialises in restorations and archive film. He was saying the problem a lot of these digital restorations have is that they completely clean it up, so that you have no sort of feeling of the film, of the celluloid. And I think the restoration they've got on that Blu-ray absolutely sort of retains that grain.
It certainly retains the grain. It shows up a lot of technical deficiencies that I'd never noticed before. I've always loved that Dalek spaceship. I've always thought it's great. I have never, though, noticed that you can very visibly see strings on top of it.
Or the join where it's kind of crashing into the mine.
Yeah.
Between the two bits of footage that are spliced together. However, you know, I think it's always a really cool thing to hear Dalek voices out of a cinema sound system.
This is the second big screen Dalek outing. Not a Doctor Who outing, it's not, really. It's all about the Daleks. And it's the 50th anniversary of this, coming out 1 week after the end of broadcast of Doctor Who's third series.
Oh, right, so, I didn't know that.
So a week prior to this, we've had final episode of The War Machines.
Oh, wow. So
that happened with Doctor Who and the Daleks as well. They released it in that kind of summer period where Doctor Who, like, there was essentially no competition for it in the film, in the cinema.
Yeah.
You have the series, and then you see something completely the same but different.
I don't know how much. I mean, obviously, aside from the involvement of David Whittaker on the script.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, David Whittaker was a script editor and writer of Doctor Who.
Yes.
Television and novels.
Yeah. He was Mr. Dalek after Terry Nation.
After Terry Nation, the creator of the Daleks.
Yeah. Some would say maybe better than Terry Nation.
Some would say, yes. Certainly, I think a lot of the Dalek popularity, I think, could trace back to some of the stuff David Whittaker does, and certainly how we have the Daleks now, to something like Evil of the Daleks or Power of the Daleks.
Yeah,
I think it's his kind of footprint in there. But yeah, I don't know how much involvement they actually had other than licensing the script and sort of the involvement of Terry Nation and David Whittaker.
There's a music cue that's basically identical to some of the music that is used in the BBC serial, The Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Which is surely a deliberate.
I would think so, yeah. It's that kind of weird kind of like, you know, panicked bongo.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Panicked bongo.
Which they don't really use anywhere else in the film. It's just at that section.
Yeah.
And I think when you think of Dalek Invasion of Earth music, you think of that kind of weird, like, kind of that bongo music as Barbara and is it Dortmund are doing that flee across London. So there was a strange look. There was a little nod there. So
it's, oh, I think, maybe, yeah, I mean, I think that's
there was
right.
maybe elements within the production of this film that seemed like they wanted to acknowledge the original source material.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't just a kind of, you know, like a, you know, like a cut and, no, no, what am I saying, like a smash and grab on
yes.
the best elements of it. You know?
And I mean, talking about the sort of the influence on back on the television series, obviously this is, brief sort of historical background, this was Amicus sort of trying to do what Hammer had been doing recently with sort of family movies for the kind of school holidays.
Yeah.
So I think at this point Hammer were doing pirate films. I don't know, I can't remember the names of them, but there was sort of like a series of kind of piratey kind of family films.
Yeah.
So Amicus...
Was Blackbeard one of them? Was that a Disney
film? I would imagine there's more than one adaptation. Yeah. But yeah, there is certainly a Disney one. Or is there actually? Maybe it is... No, maybe it is Hammer that did Blackbeard.
Yeah. I mean, I would say probably the most famous of that kind of era of films is... I think in the running for one of the greatest trilogies in cinema history.
Okay.
The On the Buses trilogy.
Well, this is another thing.
They're from like, I think, 71, 72, yeah. 73. So this is after this point.
Yeah.
But it's obviously a sustained decade or so that Hammer are doing this kind of... It's yeah. not just horror. It's family films.
Yeah. And so Amicus kind of wanted to kind of get on board with this, and they licensed out the Daleks, made the first Dalek film, which was incredibly popular. It came out in the year before, so 1965.
Yeah, it was the break. So it was basically again. So this came out. Dalek Invasion of Earth came out a week after the end of War Machines.
Yep.
First film came out a week after the end of The Time Meddler.
Right. Okay. Okay. Cool. So that was the. I think it was. Yeah. It was in the. It was number 20 in the top 20 films in the UK box office for that year. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, they're like, well, let's make a sequel, as we're so used to now in the sort of landscape we have.
That's interesting. Wasn't 65, wasn't that, wasn't the top film, wasn't it Goldfinger, I think?
Possibly, it certainly would have been, I think it certainly would have been a Bond.
Oh, was it that bizarre year where like number two was a Bond film and number one was like a Norman Wisdom film as like the biggest? Was it a square peg round hole and that
possibly
Thunderball or something like that?
Possibly. Oh, but yeah, that's a whole separate discussion. Yeah, I wonder. But certainly, it was number 20.
Yeah, it's punted, in good company.
Yeah, they punted some more money into the. I think it was £268,000. I think. Was spent on this Dalek Invasion Earth.
In additional to the...
No, it was 100,000 extra, and I think the Daleks was 168,000.
Right, okay.
And this was 268,000 now.
So they thought they were entrenched. They thought this was going to be a yearly thing,
yes.
A new Dalek movie.
Yeah. Now, there's various reasons why... Well, actually, first of all, in terms of the funding, £50,000 of that funding. Yeah. Actually, you know, 268,000 is nothing for a film now. And actually, I think even then that was a pretty low budget for a motion picture. £50,000 of that budget was from Quaker Oats.
Okay.
Which is why, and having read this before watching the film again, I was just so distracted by it. Which is why every now and again, the camera will either linger on or characters will walk past. Adverts for Sugar Puffs.
Of course, yes.
They're so prominently displayed.
They are.
Yeah, right? You look back and you go, oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and so the TARDIS first lands.
In that little archway, there's a Sugar Puffs poster.
Of course. And it is so noticeable. It's so comedically noticeable.
Yeah.
You go, oh, 2150.
Yeah,
sugar puffs are still down well.
So clearly that sugar tax that is coming in.
Yeah. I mean, we're in 2016 now, and sugar puffs are quite on the decline, but they're coming back,
my friends. Coming back. There was sort of promotional tie-ins. I think there was a competition on Sugar Puffs to win a life-size prop from the film.
Right, okay.
So all that kind of thing.
Well, sugar puffs... I think, is it better, is it worse than a signage that says, please do not dump dead bodies in the river from the original cereal?
It's certainly more jovial. You know. So I find that really interesting that they kind of
you know, I don't know if it's the first, well, I know it's not the first instance of product placement in a film. I'm sure you know plenty of other films, but I do find that.
do you know, actually?
Because £50,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you know what the first film is that actively engaged product placement to provide its budget?
No, I don't think I do.
It was the very last film the Marx Brothers ever did, called Love Happy.
Okay.
In 1949, I think.
Right.
So there's this whole like kind of weird chase across rooftops in a city, and all in the background as they jump from building to building, you can see these billboards of various products. As Harpo and Cho are creating this chase across the skyscape, everything that invested in some way is represented in this kind of weird, you know, like one of those like Scooby-Doo chases.
Yes.
They're like in ridiculously long corridors, but it's sort of like the same vase every like couple of seconds. It's whoever's given money.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. Actually, a couple of them were cigarettes. That's why it's
yeah.
Not
yeah, well,
often.
I guess yeah. 1949. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Would it be? Yeah. God, that's funny. But I, you know, £50,000 out of 268 is a substantial amount of money.
Yeah.
So you start to go, oh, okay, yeah, that's why there's Sugar Puss posters everywhere.
Yeah. The restraint that company must have had. I mean, you could have, for that money, you could have demanded more. I want Doctor Who eating a giant bowl
and
of
going,
Quaker Oats.
Sugar Puffs.
Yeah, with milk and his little
moustache. I've travelled all around the universe and I haven't found a cereal as delicious as Sugar Puffs.
they were quite
all
hands,
the time and space.
Quite hands off in that respect.
Yeah, I guess, you know, just a few posters and a promotional opportunity, which, you know, let's face it, benefits the film as much as it benefits the.
Sure, sure.
Obviously, what we have is this. I would say the best of the two big screen adaptations.
Yeah, it's the it's the one I like the best, I think.
Mm.
Because I actually find the first one a bit of a snooze fest.
Yes.
But then I kind of think that the original serial's a bit of a snooze fest at some point.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously both of them are adapted from the first two Dalek serials as well. And yeah, I kind of agree with you. So yeah, so what we have is this. They're adapted from these TV serials. And like you've already pointed out, there's the sort of sound cues and there's little nods to the TV series and stuff like that. But actually, if you look at the nods back, so like we've already discussed, Nicholas Briggs's Dalek voice is very much influenced by this film more than it is the television serial, which we've discussed on, you know, the parent podcast, shall we call it, on the Time Lash. That it's sometimes odd to go back and watch those old Dalek serials and not hear that.
Yes, yeah.
Nick Briggs style voice.
Yeah, it's really off-putting.
Yeah.
There's many reasons why Death to the Daleks is off-putting, but one of the things is just trying to get your head around the kind of odd, whispering Michael Wisher voice to Daleks.
Yeah, it's an odd thing, where you want that kind of harsh, grating
voice. Well, let's call it Big Finish voices, because that's where it started.
That is where it started, yeah, and that's how Briggs got the job. And then also, the TARDIS itself, not the inside, but certainly the outer police box, that design, that's Matt Smith's TARDIS. You know, it's not the Hartnell one, because the Hartnell one's tatty and it's battered and it's dusty. And yeah, fine, it's got a St. John's Ambulance sticker on the front of it.
That peels away by the time Marco Polo says cheerio.
Exactly. You know, a few spins in the time vortex, that sticker's coming off.
Yeah.
But that Matt Smith TARDIS is, you know, it's that rich blue, it's the Peter Cushing TARDIS.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
yeah. So obviously they're like, and also the new Daleks as well.
Yes, yeah, so from 2005 on, you can certainly see that those Daleks are influenced by the big screen Daleks.
Yeah.
But in terms of the weird, rich, multicoloured kind of.
Yeah, which.
That's the paradigm Daleks.
Yeah, which we will discuss.
Yeah. But then it is also as well to see there are Dalek colorations which are picked up by 70s Doctor Who when the Daleks and John Pertwee meet. You know, like the gold and black Daleks. Those are the Day of the Daleks.
Well, that gold
Daleks,
and black, I think it's the gold and black prop in this film gets used again
in Planet of the
Daleks, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it gets purple lights rather than.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, so there is obviously a sharing of resources. In the chase, some dummy Daleks, so, you know, no, there isn't an operator in them, they're just to be sitting in the background. Some of those are the movie Daleks, so Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Right.
I think they do use some of the TV Daleks as kind of prop stuff for the films.
Okay, yeah, maybe, perhaps.
Because the BBC is getting money for this, so they're happy to lend out their props.
Yeah, exactly. So setting the scene in a very roundabout way, as we've done for the past 20 minutes or whatever it's been. It's a big screen adaptation of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It's mutually beneficial to all parties, you know, the BBC, Amicus, Milton Subotsky, the screenwriter, the producers.
I think fandom is also, not even in its infancy, it's in its embryonic stage, that I really don't think fans, kids at that point, would give a... They wouldn't care about the complete inconsistencies. Well, I mean, the thing is, but they would have done 2 years ago. So this is still basically new to them.
Yeah.
And I don't think they would care about the inconsistencies about the Doctor being Doctor Who. And he's human.
No, and I think, you know, what people forget when they talk about the Dalek films and stuff like that is that it was a proper cultural phenomenon, the Daleks. Not so much Doctor Who. I think that comes later.
Yeah.
Really, the love and the esteem, and then the falling out with, and then the restored love and esteem the Doctor Who has.
Yeah.
It was the Daleks first. That was what captured people's imaginations.
Yeah.
And that's why they went, right, well, how can we capitalise on success? What's a family product that we can use to kind of compete with Hammer? Oh, the Daleks.
Yeah.
They're really popular. Because 65 was that kind of peak period, wasn't it, of Dalek mania, as it was known.
Well, yeah, that's why they commissioned 12 parts of the Dalek Master Plan.
Yeah,
that's why they also had that they took the risk by having a complete standalone Dalek story.
By themselves, for 25 minutes.
Doctor Who not in it at all. You know, like, we also had the Chase as well. The Chase was closing up one series, and the Dalek Master Plan came along very soon after the start of that new series, the series 3.
So, I mean, and that's what it is. And it's also doing what British cinema has always done, which I think nowadays is a bit of a cultural concern. I think back in the 60s and 70s, maybe less so, that thing of, oh, it's the big screen adaptation of a television property.
Right, yes, yeah.
And I think, is this the first instance?
Is it?
Because Step Two and Son, as you've already mentioned, on the buses,
Dad's Army,
all of those were George the 70s. Mildred. That was 70s British cinema. Yeah. Was essentially just like, shall we make new? No. Nobody wants to watch gritty gangster films. And actually, we'll maybe discuss this a bit further later on.
Yeah.
And because I think there's a reason for that's tied into why Dalek Invasion Earth wasn't very successful at the box office. She says, just do it now.
Because if you're asking, do I know if it's the first thing, I don't know, but there's every possibility that it is one of the very first films.
Yeah, Doctor Who and the Daleks. I can't think of a TV series beforehand that was as popular as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And I certainly can't think of one that was as popular that spawned films. Because Dad's Army was about the same. Was that 69?
Dad's Army was 69 or 70, I think, yeah.
Because the first couple of series are black and white.
The only thing that I can think is that you
Step
could
Two and Son.
That was 67.
And the films were like in the 70s. Yeah.
The only thing I can think is that the Carry On Sergeant is often seen as a big screen adaptation of the Army Game.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Less because it directly is, but more because all the stock characters, Bernard Breslau, Charles Hawtrey, Bill Owen, who were in the Army Game, show up in Carry On Sergeant.
As themselves?
Well, basically sort of characters, though it is not obviously, it's obviously a very different.
And obviously Carry On is a thing separate to itself, which I'm sure we will cover on this podcast at some point.
I love Carry On Sergeant, but anyway, sorry.
I think, you know, British cinema in the 70s, a lot of it was, you know, on the buses, the movie, Dad's Army, Step Towards Sunlight Again.
Well, you used a very interesting phrase. I know it's an actual genre phrase, but quota quickie.
Yes.
British cinema in the 70s was all about comic quickies.
Yeah, just churning them out.
Yeah.
You know, I think it does have its roots here, because, you know, that first Dad's Army film.
Yeah.
What the... Yeah, actually, I was about to correct myself, and I went, no, that's right, there was a second one that was out this year.
The first Dad's Army film, original Dad's Army.
Yes,
Dad's Army, the movie.
Yeah, the original Dad's Army film. The first, half of the film is essentially just repurposed bits from the first couple of series.
It's, more than that, it's basically the first half an hour is the big screen version of the pilot, the very first episode of Dad's Army.
And then it kind of goes off into like a slightly grander... Nazis invade Wilmington.
Then it becomes its own little original thing.
Yeah.
But then you've had a situation. Basically, it's the same with the Are You Being Served movie. It's the first 45 minutes is basically an Are You Being Served episode.
Yeah.
And from that, you know, start it. But then they go off and do something original.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't trust it to be a completely hour and a half original.
Yeah, because you've got to do something. I mean, the whole point with the Dalek movie is that.
Who'd have thought, really, that when you watch the film version of Up Pompeii, one of the main positives is that it genuinely had the guts and the bravery to go out and do an hour and a half of original material, not taken from the television show.
Oh God, it's actually, when you mention that Up Pompeii and I've been saying it, God, it really was. That was just British cinema in the '70s.
When you make George and Mildred the movie, we can see where you're going to be dead in a decade.
Now we roll our eyes when Ab Fab comes out, or like when Mrs. Brown's Boys the movie comes out. But we've never had it so good in some respects, you know.
Because these things only happen once or twice.
A year. This year it's been a bit more because we've got David Brent coming out as well. So that's like Dad's Army, Ab Fab. Yeah. David Brent.
But at least with David Brent, that is...
It's an original...
Yeah.
So was Ab Fab, and Dad's Army was its own thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But it's...
Can't believe we didn't have a Last of the Summer Wine movie. Can't believe that's not in there.
It was too late, I think. It was too late. Because I have always stated that if British cinema was in a slightly healthier state in the 80s...
Yeah.
We would have had Miami Twice on the big screen. We would have. That's what would have happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's. There's going to be people listening to this going, I was struggling with the Doctor Who references, and now they're just referencing all these British sitcoms.
Yeah. But I can believe that we've traced back the fall of British cinema to Daleks Invasion 2020.
But the reason I think that, and this ties into this Sporing Life, which we're going to discuss in our next one, is that British cinema in the 60s, or the point at which this comes out. So you've got the free cinema movement, so that's Lindsay Anderson, Carl Rice, releasing films like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, This Sporting Life. And they don't do well. They're championed critically as this brave new direction for British cinema. And it's something that obviously influences filmmakers today, and sort of certainly that kind of social realist aesthetic that I think a lot of British cinema is known for.
It's the cinema answer or addition to the conversation.
Yeah.
The more kind of realism you got on the stage.
Yes, exactly.
With Joe Orton and
all of them
Look Back in Anger.
Yeah, exactly. They all had their roots in novels and in plays by people like
Look Back in Anger. Who wrote that?
John Osborne.
Billy Lyre, I suppose. Keith Waterhouse. Cinema and theatre were doing in the 60s.
Which, you know, arguably, you know, that's no different from adapting a television programme.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the subject matter of those things, it's angry young men, it's post-war Britain, and the problems that arises from that. And audiences clearly didn't want that.
Yeah.
Audiences clearly wanted escapism, clearly wanted... And I've got, you know, I think it's...
They wanted Barbara Windsor's top flying off into Kenneth Williams' face.
Exactly. But I mean, I think it's been said by more intelligent people than me that I think one of the appeals of Doctor Who, when it started in 1963, was that it kind of offered this hopeful vision of the future.
Yeah.
This kind of thing that, you know, anything was possible, you could go anywhere, you could do anything. And it was like moving away from this kind of, from rationing, from like bombed out streets that were still being rebuilt.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks that you can tie in the kind of failure of stuff like this Sporting Life and Saturday Night Sunday Morning at the box office with the failure of Dalek Invasion Earth at the box office, because the Daleks, it's a big, brash, colourful adventure on an alien planet.
Yeah.
Dalek Invasion Earth is a bleak vision, and as you've already pointed out, it's a very regressive society. Yeah. It almost looks like 1960s Britain.
It looks like 1950s Britain.
So
everybody has got a flat cap and a cigarette hanging out of their mouth. Everyone's got these kind of grubby Macintoshes. All the vans that they drive are just clapped out museum pieces. Everyone looks so dour and gloomy.
And that's, I think, because that's all in the trailers. I think a lot of people just put it down to, oh, well, nobody wants to see the Daleks on screen anymore. I think it's a much wider thing. And it's that thing of people wanting to move away from the imagery of the war and put that behind them and move on and look forward in this positive light.
1965, you're slap bang in not just the kind of the youthful, I don't want to say summer of love, that was 67, 68 popularly thought, but you've got the advent of the Beatles, the Stones.
Yeah.
You also, I would argue as well, have the, you're right in the middle of the satire boom.
If
you want to address something, it's not about kind of regressive navel gazing, it's about like sharp cutting statement and action.
Yeah.
It's about comedy, it's about laughs, it's about being, it's about aspiring to be out of the thing rather than to wallow in the misery of the thing.
And I think that's it, because, you can go blue in the face and just go, oh, the Daleks are an allegory for the Nazis.
Yeah.
But that's it. It's, you know, it's bombed out London.
Yeah.
It's basically presenting audiences with a vision of what would have happened if the Nazis won the war.
Yeah.
And arguably, that's not what people want to watch in the summer holidays.
No, I think I think there are some. There are some. It's almost, the film seems almost designed like, it's designed to be a Saturday morning entertainment picture for
kids. Of course it is.
Where you've just had like a big brashy explosive attack on a Dalek saucer.
Yeah.
And then you have Bernard Cribbins doing a little Charlie Chaplin routine.
Yeah, which
from
is
the
very
film.
Funny.
Very funny, but then you're completely, it's such a tonal shift into this kind of weird little modern times esque kind of fight with RoboMen
and
machinery.
Yeah, and satire about being told when to eat and when not to eat.
So you go from this explosion and attacks and all that, and but you also get like really great, I think really great scenes like when Dortmund goes into his office and is it David and the other guy, the kind of Scottish guy looks after Susan,
Andrew Keir, I can't remember his name,
and they formulate a plan of disguising themselves as a RoboMan with no dialogue at all. One of them, Dortmund, holds up the helmet, they pass it around, they look at each other, there's close-ups on each of their faces as you then work out the plan with them, and you go immediately, yep, that's what we're doing. Now that is such an economical, creative way to just get, firstly, the plot moving, but to create something incredibly visually interesting that, as an audience, it demands your attention to work out the motivations and the ideas of these characters.
Yeah.
So you go, who's that for? That's not for the kids. That's not for the kids jumping about in the cinema.
Yeah.
Who's that? Is that for the adults? Because in this period really is about kids going to the cinema themselves and...
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? You know, it's like your mum and dad would drop you off at the cinema and pick you up at the end.
Yeah, so it's like Gordon Fleming, the director, has went, I want to put my more adult mark as a filmmaker on this film. And as a result, you're right, feeding into what you've said, it probably fails because it doesn't engage with the target market.
Yeah, it's funny because it's funny you say that, because I found an old review from the Times of Dalek Invasion Earth 2150 AD. And it had a really lovely, it's not a very favourable review, but it has a really lovely phrase which I think you can apply to Doctor Who itself in various periods throughout its 50 odd years, which is, grown-ups may enjoy it, but children will know better. A lot of Doctor Who in the 1980s, you could level that criticism at.
Yes, I absolutely get that.
I think there is just something in that, of, we've done this, And as you say, you know, if you want to comment on something, you just confront it head on.
Yeah.
Instead of presenting these kind of distancing science fiction allegories for stuff that's happened and stuff that we can't do anything about.
Yeah.
You know, it's all in the past. Because it is. It, you know, it's work camps. It's people huddled in the underground.
Yeah.
It's all just evoking that. And I mean, the original TV serial does the same, but I think there's just something more vivid about the way the film does it.
Yeah.
Because you've got a bigger budget to, you know, so you can have more extras and you can give it this sense of a proper community under siege.
Yeah. But I think, though, bizarrely, the science fiction element of the original serial is far more overt. It was never done in any particular visual style. It was all done in dialogue. But I remember a scene, essentially, where the Doctor and Ian get captured and they're speaking to like somebody they're in a cell with, and the guy gives them a rundown of exactly how this came about, and he says something like, our moon bases detected the Daleks arriving, and then they hit us with a plague, and there's all these, you're not seeing it, but you're getting all these science fiction terms which excite the viewer a bit more.
And also, it gives you a sense that this is a society that is in the future and was then brought back down, whereas this, all you're getting is kind of society. Take away the bombed out scenery for a second, you know, the vans, the costumes, just look out your window and you see.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have that kind of like vibrant science fiction-y elements that the first film had, or like you say, is mentioned and alluded to in the in the original TV serial.
You know, because what that original series couldn't do was obviously show stuff, so they wrote it into dialogue. This film seems almost willful in that it wants to represent Britain in a I mean, obviously we're watching it in 2016, we're watching it 50 years later. So there's obviously laughs.
There's more
to be,
now than there was then.
There's obviously laughs to be gotten for the fact that if a character is having a couple of characters having some dialogue, and in the background you can see a map of the London Underground as it then was. In the 60s, but this is 2150, so you can see London transport links get worse over the next century. Where's Crossrail in that thing? Why are they never going down the stairs on like electric stairs? They're just using actual stairs. But there are, you know, like, presumably because it has the budget, it has to make bold decisions about what it's representing. It has to create the stages that the actors perform on. And it does itself a disservice. Where the original series, or the original serial, can be, it can get away with a couple of lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
It softens the blow. It engages more with concepts and ideas for people, so they don't feel so bogged down in, you know, like a misery that is getting particularly irksome to a whole society.
And also,
by 65.
You know, you're only spending time in that society's company for 25 minutes on television every week.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, it's 84 minutes, you know, of misery. In a way, I think it's an enjoyable experience, an enjoyable film. But I think, you know, if you're taking just this depiction of the Daleks, it's very grey, it's very drab, it's very...
It's earth colours.
Yeah.
It's very...
Even on the Dalek spaceship.
It's obviously filmed in January and February of 1965, 1966, it does. It looks the complete opposite of what must have been the positive bubblegum experience that was the first film.
Because that was the major selling point of these films, was, you know, see, you know, Doctor Who and fight the Daleks in colour, in Technicolor, on the big screen. That's a hell of a selling point at that point, when it was this massive cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe why, that's the other reason why I don't think this did as well, because it's on Earth, it's, you know, clearly filmed in winter.
Yeah.
It's drab, it's just grey, and even when they get on board the Dalek ship, you know, it's still these kind of sort of like sandstony colours. There's nothing kind of...
Well, the it looks cheap.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's very obvious concrete walls, and when they don't have the budget for concrete walls, they have gossamer curtaining.
Yeah.
For some reason. With the hoods of phone booths stuck to the walls for robo-men to put their heads in. it does look cheap. There is something about that type of spaceship that really reminded me of Plan 9 from Outer Space spaceships. You know, Plan 9 from Outer Space is basically like some curtaining.
Yeah.
some curtaining with like a guy at a desk, and that's the bridge of the ship. That's Ed Wood. Basically, like Ed Wood is the scenic director of this film.
But the positives.
Well, what are the positives? Peter Cushing is great.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think, but I don't know if this is just because I'm so familiar with Doctor Who and with the original story and with William Hartnell.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like an impression.
Yes, I get that.
But I do think he's a more personable.
Who is he like? When I try to think of comparing him to any doctor that we've ever had, do you know what? He's more like a Matt Smith doctor. He's probably the only doctor that you could genuinely feel like isn't just an irascible, arced character every now and then.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe Matt Smith, maybe Patrick Troughton. But Patrick Troughton is very... He's very big in his performance.
Yes.
He's very flappy. He flaps about. He's really not the first Doctor that you're familiar with on television. He's a warm, grandfatherly...
Yeah, he is.
...type of Doctor. And I really appreciate that. I really like that kind of thing. You know?
Me too. I've always liked Cushing as Doctor Who for, you know, although they do refer to him as the Doctor.
They do. But I just love that scene at the beginning where he's introduced. I'm Doctor Who.
Yes.
And this is Susan and this is Louise.
Louise Who.
Get your passports out. Is that your actual Susan Who, Louise Who?
The Who family. It's funny. I mean, I think calling the Doctor Who is quite a fun thing to do to wind people up. But obviously in this, that is the name that he was doing.
But it's more than that. I mean, like, it's a completely different character.
He's a human scientist who has invented time travel.
Yeah.
And also dimensional engineering.
Yes.
And picks people up every now and again, goes on a little adventure.
Yeah.
Bumps into the Daleks.
Seems to have a greater control over his TARDIS. Sorry, not his TARDIS.
TARDIS.
It's TARDIS in the way that Enterprise is the name of the ship.
Yep.
So it's obviously different. Is it worth talking about the theory that Stephen Moffat had about Day of the Doctor?
He was going to put it in, wasn't he? He just didn't get around. It wasn't filmed, was it? It was written, but
I'm not quite sure. So what he wanted in Day of the Doctor is when Clara goes into the Black Archive.
Yeah.
And you've got all these images of the Doctor's various companions. He wanted to have the poster for Doctor and the Daleks, so the Dalek Invasion of Earth. And these were supposed to be big screen versions of, I don't know, say Ian had been talking to a guy in a pub, and that guy was like a filmmaker, and he'd taken that idea, he'd bought the story from Ian Chesterton and Barbara, and created a Doctor Who. So these, but with little changes.
Yes.
Because I suppose that works. Ian doesn't really know about Gallifrey and Time Lords and all that kind of stuff. It's a period where the show is still very mysterious.
And I think also that the reason he's an Earth scientist is also for that really, boring reason of that at this point, Doctor Who is very well known in the UK.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
So, if you're trying to sell a film to foreign markets, surely it's instead of having the mystery that we have in that first episode, you go, well, he's an Earth scientist, he's invented this time machine, and they go off and have adventures.
Yeah, that's it. That's how you start it. It's also less to explain to whoever has stumbled in.
When you've only got 84 minutes to tell a story.
Yeah, although I did like at the start of the film that they did give each of the Doctor, Louise and Susan their own little close-up hero shot.
Yes.
When Bernard Cribbin stumbles in, it's like they're each given a, and you see particularly Peter Cushing's face.
Yeah.
As if, remember these guys?
Yeah.
remember that TV show? Don't even worry about that.
Yeah.
Because this is the big screen.
I'm in charge now.
Remember you enjoyed it so much last year? Well, this is what's happening. The old team is back together.
That's nice. And I think the thing is, there's this tendency from Doctor Who fans, because I was doing some research on this, and I found like a message board, and it was like, to say that, these films fit into the canon through an alternative universe is not enough. And I'm like, why are you trying to fit in? it's just a film. It's just a film. And the landscape of the entertainment at the time meant that, you know, you could do a big screen adaptation of a television programme because nobody thought that people would watch the television programme again.
Yeah.
And this was just a new way to enjoy something. And also the reason he's an earth scientist is so that they can sell it to foreign markets that hadn't seen Doctor Who. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why can't you? And the Stephen Moffat thing is a lovely touch.
It is a lovely touch.
For an anniversary story.
You keep trying to work out the mind of the rabid, ardent fan, and it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
So obviously another big link with Doctor Who from that we would recognise now is we've got Bernard Cribbins as the companion, Tom Campbell, but he's playing the Ian, he's playing the Stephen, I suppose, he's playing the Ben, since we've just had the introduction of Ben and Polly in War Machines. If you're looking for Wilf, this is not him.
No, it's not him,
he's playing... I don't know, I wanted to see more from Bernard Cribbins, and his role is very narrow.
He starts off... really great, he gets a lot of stuff to do, he tries to stop the jewellery thieves, he gets knocked on the head, he stumbles into the TARDIS, him and the Doctor go off and find out what's going on, and then he kind of just hides in the shed with Joel Curzon, which I'm sure is a lovely experience, but that's it for quite a bit, and then he kind of gets to knock over some wooden planks to redirect a very heavy looking bomb. Yes. I think we'd have just
smashed all the way through those no boards. Problem. Yeah. I guess he's a casualty of the fact that they kept, it looks like, the full complement of supporting characters from the original series.
Which was for what? A serial that was about 2 and a bit hours?
Yeah, 2.5 hours, 2 hours, 40 minutes, I think. It was 6 episodes originally. Yeah. And everyone gets paired off with someone.
Yeah.
And the people who come off the worst are the, let's call them, the regulars.
Yes.
Really, Jill Curzon as Louise, what does she have to do in this thing?
Not much.
Not at
all. She runs around, hides.
That's really it. And even the thing, I think didn't Peter Cushing's role have to be slightly reduced in this as well, because he was ill at the time of filming?
He was ill during the filming, I believe, so they had to push the film. I think it says they stopped filming for 2 weeks, but I don't know if that's true or if they just filmed other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But he was certainly ill during the filming of the film.
Yeah. So maybe that is another reason as well. Maybe just the characters are not particularly rich in this one.
Yeah.
Even though you're vying for them to be.
Because I think what happens with in Doctor Who and the Daleks is that you're with these characters, they land on this alien planet, and they get stuff to do because, first of all, the other characters aren't that interesting. I think the characters here are very interesting, and you kind of demand their own screen time.
Yeah.
So then the other characters kind of just fall by the wayside because it becomes about the resistance. And I think it ties back to that thing that you said at the start where you're just like, this is not a Doctor Who movie, this is a Daleks movie.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously you focus on the resistance against the Daleks.
Yeah. Well, exactly, yeah.
So then everybody kind of falls in line with that group rather than has their own individual moments.
I mean, it is, even if you look at the title of the film.
Yeah.
It's, it's Daleks as in, you might as well have, the words Disney up there. This is a film that is completely brought to you and is the product of the Daleks. It's not about, it's not Daleks, dot dot Invasion Earth. It's the Daleks.
Yeah.
This film's called Invasion Earth 2150 and it's by the Daleks.
Yeah, yes.
You know, am I right in thinking in Blake 7 it was Terry Nation?
Terry Nation's
Blake 7 or Terry Nation's the survivors. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that the attempt to portray a grim invasion-soaked Britain is not what an audience wanted. It's done with too much conviction.
Yeah.
And I think that is why we don't have the big screen version of The Chase.
The Chase, which would have been was the third Dalek serial and was therefore proposed as the third Dalek film.
Yeah. Which I think if they'd given that a go would have got them back on track with what was the winning formula for those films.
That first film that got them into the top 20 British film.
Would have been colourful, would have been funny, it would have been goofy, it would have been silly. It would have also have had quite the scope. You know that type that type of 60s film, you know, like Mad World, where it's all
you could have done
brilliant amount of locations as well.
Yeah, you definitely could have done something like that with it. So it's kind of a shame. I think, I don't know, I think it's a product of its time.
Yeah.
And I think if you know, the idea of a Doctor Who film continues to this day.
Yeah.
And I don't think we need one. I think, I'm not to do any disrespect to these films, because I think they come out of a period in which that was something that you did, and that was something that, and there was certainly audience interest in it, because you know you could rewatch the old stuff. But I think now, when you basically you film a special 70-minute episode of Doctor Who and put it on the cinema and it beats The Hunger Games in the US on opening weekend, you don't really need to put all your time and money into making a feature film version. Really, you know.
But Doctor from the very beginning of its creation was serials.
Yeah.
It was a movie length story over a couple of weeks.
True. You know,
more than that. So yeah, okay. So if we're kind of arguing ourselves out of having enjoyed the film.
I know.
And I really enjoyed the film. Now, was it just the occasion that we gave it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I've always liked this film over Doctor Who and the Daleks. I've always enjoyed watching it on TV. I've always enjoyed watching it on video. What do I like about it? I don't know. The Daleks are really appealing, isn't it?
The Daleks are great, and they look great. I mean, there's...
Yeah.
I was at
because they are genuinely sinister.
Yeah, they are.
In this, and manipulative.
And they're beautifully shot as well. Yeah. The way that the shot, like Gordon Fleming frames a shot, and he's got, you know, like armies of Daleks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was at the BFI for a thing recently where they were talking about sort of the future of British film, and the sizzle reel they played at the start, right? So they have like all these clips of like, you know, great British movies and stuff like that.
I hate that phrase. Sizzle.
It's horrible, right? But anyway, the sizzle reel that they played, one of the clips was the van
smashing
through the Daleks. I mean, it looks great. It looks great on the big screen. It looks great. It is really... There's some really great action set pieces in it.
It's it is directed very well. I mean, Doctor Who was never known for the believability or proficiency of its fighting.
No.
But there is some really great stuff in this film. Although, when the Doctor Who says attack the Daleks into the microphone, I just thought it was so ridiculous.
That was so funny, you just burst out laughing.
When the Robo-Men just rip their helmets off and start pummeling like it is some sort of Glasgow barroom brawl on a Saturday.
I know, it's like, oh, well, if only they had one of those microphones earlier, all of this could have been avoided.
It's like the Robo-Men have just been dying.
Attention, Robo-Men. Just ignore everything the Daleks say to you. Thanks. Put that microphone back in its cradle and everything is fine.
This cannot be countermanded. That is... Loved it. What else is good?
Philip Maddock
is brilliant.
In the sort of 10 minutes that he's there.
He's wandered in from another film. I don't know exactly what film that is, but
I'm not sure, but it's certainly again that kind of Second World War quizzling kind of character. Yeah. He's kinda in it for the money. Mm. He's just, you know, manipulating the situation for his own ends. And I just absolutely, like, I just started giggling away the bit where the Doctor, like, goes, oh, we'll need some plans for the mine. And Maddock goes, I think I might be able to sort that out for you. And he sort of takes a draw on his cigarette and just, like, looks into the camera for what seems like the longest time.
It's such a lingering...
This just wonderfully devilish smile. It's great.
Yeah, but it's so... I don't know, it's funny you talk about the quizzling, because one of the scenes that I really like, but then again, it's exactly what you say, like, there's nothing in there for a family audience, even though this is a family movie, is the creepy, sinister quality of the two women that run the house. and the grass up. I can't remember what
the
character's name.
Susie Who.
Oh, Wyler. 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 Yeah. Susie Who and Wyler. Played by Eileen Way as the older woman, who was old woman in the very first Doctor Who
season. I know. Because I never knew that was her until today. I saw her name in the credits. I was like, Eileen Way? Fantastic.
Yeah. There's just something, I don't know, like this unreal kind of, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like there's a lot of American Civil War films.
Right.
That have that kind of.
Yes.
You know, like the kind of people who live in a bayou.
Take shelter.
Come on, here, yeah. Soldier. Are you deserting? Yes, ma'am. And then he's like locked up in chains the next day, you know.
Definitely.
I love that scene. I don't know. It's a good, like, it's 85 minutes. It's a good.
It zips along. Like,
it's, we did it on a Sunday.
Yeah.
It's not that great weather outside. We did it, you know. I'm not a tennis fan. I don't. You know, I don't care what happens at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
We did it. We watched it. It was great. I enjoyed it.
It was. It was really good. And like I say, I mean, I think, you know, we both enjoyed it, not on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a great quote from David Lynch, where he goes, you think you've seen a film on your fucking phone? Which is kind of this wonderful testament to, you know, the power of the big screen and to see it all up and...
Yeah, he's right.
And he is right. I mean, I think, you know... You can totally, you know, a film stands up on its own fine, you know, regardless of its setting, I think. A good film is a good film, regardless. But there's an added dimension when you've got the proper speakers, when you've got it up on the big screen, and the colours, you know, although as we've discussed in this, aren't perhaps as vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, seeing a big red and silver Dalek and the gold Dalek and stuff like that, and the sound of them, and... It's great.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Do you know what's an interesting thing? I actually felt, I know this is a Dalek movie, but I did find myself more on the side of the Daleks because they did seem far more familiar to me than the elements. The way that the red Dalek looked, he looks like the Supreme Dalek from Journey's End. the way they sound, we've spoken about this, but they all seem like... the legitimate baddies from something I like. The legitimate characters coming into like some kind of weird alternative something else I'm not quite sold on.
It almost feels like a spin-off, doesn't it? Of the main show where you go, well, you know, I wasn't always the best, like, you know, like Frasier, for example. Like, you know, Cheers, I mean, I think Frasier, the series is great, but in Cheers he was never my favourite character.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Frasier the TV show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that with the Dalek movie, isn't it? It's like, well, you know, I know the Daleks and the bad guys, and I root for the Doctor more often than not, and Doctor Who. But now they've got their own little spin-off adventure.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see them win.
Yeah.
Kind of like them, actually.
So you can begin to see what the appeal would be for... Because I know Terry Nation did try and push it, an American Dalek TV show.
Series, and I think if...
And nice, I mean, you know, so we don't have the Dalek TV show, but we do have the Century 21 Dalek comics, where the Daleks are the stars. And we regularly... Okay, I say we. Not that I was buying this comic and it was the evil
at the time,
in
the 60s. Yeah.
But in looking at comics, when the Daleks get eaten by sea monsters in their own planet, you feel sad for the Daleks.
Yeah.
When they lose,
poor Dalek Zog or whatever they're doing. They had names and stuff, didn't they?
They all had names, like the original Cybermen. They all had names. So you are definitely on the side of the Daleks.
Yeah. Wonder if anybody, you know, who didn't watch Doctor or who wasn't aware of Doctor Who actually bothered to go and see it? Because I wonder what's in it for them.
Well, there's really, it's not a date movie.
No.
It really isn't a date movie. It's not a movie for anybody who. For you know, like literati or
hello.
No, but you know, like nobody, you know, like.
Do you know what, actually a funny thing about that? I think it was this one. It was maybe for Doctor Who and the Daleks, but they took a bunch of Daleks to Cannes. So I just absolutely adore the idea of you know, people like Jean-Luc Godard and André Bazin,
Wells.
And Orson Welles and all these filmmakers from around the world, Usman Simbeh, all these like highbrow filmmakers from around the world, you know, wandering around Cannes and just Daleks everywhere. just a great image.
Yeah,
nullifying. Really,
really. It reminds me of very recently Stephen Moffat was awarded an honorary doctorate.
Yes, he was
from
the
University of the West of Scotland, and somebody had brought along a kind of grey Genesis era Dalek.
Oh, really?
For him to pose next to. And anyone who's graduated will go, there is a solemnity, there's a pomp and ceremony of this thing. To have that then punctured by like some local enthusiast bringing a homemade Dalek along.
Although arguably Daleks at Cannes is just replacing one...
Sounds like a Helen Reyes story.
Daleks turning up at Cannes is essentially just replacing one form of insufferable purist with another, you could argue.
That's why this is on the Time Lash Film Club, everybody.
I'll work in more of these hilarious highbrow film jokes in there.
But yeah, okay, so 50th anniversary. I'm glad this film exists.
Yeah, absolutely. It's...
And
I think, you know, I think when you appreciate the film on its own merits and why it exists and what it was trying to do, I think for the most part it succeeds. I think, as we've discussed, you know, the problems with it are that maybe it goes a bit too bleak.
Yeah.
You know, whereas
it's too relentingly bleak. There's a lot of moments of charm that are taken out in the transition from the serial to the movie.
Yeah.
Nobody ever has a laugh.
Apart from the bit where they put the Robo-Man helmet
sure,
and have a little bit of a chuckle.
But I'm kind of thinking of, you know, and obviously this is not possible because Susan is now an underage child, but halfway through the Dalek invasion of Earth, you get that kind of like those heartwarming moments of Susan and David kind of beginning a little romance where all the destruction round about them, they're suddenly cancelled out by these little warm moments. There aren't really those moments of charm or warmth. Everybody is just willfully and, you know, incredibly focused on being morose.
Yeah. I mean,
Weiler,
the best you get,
David, Dortmund.
Yeah, the best you get is Cribbins's Robo-Man scene.
But it seems so grafted in to provide some... It looks exactly like something that they've looked at, like a rough cut of the film, and went, oh, fuck, we're going to have to put a joke in here.
Or they've gone, well, we've got Bernard Cribbins, we might as well get him to do something funny.
Noted film comedian, television comedian Bernard Cribbins. Let's write him a little sketch that we'll call him back afterwards. Or maybe if Cushing was ill, that's exactly the same thing that just hastily written to use a filming day. You know?
Yeah. But yeah, I'm glad it exists. You know, happy 50th birthday to Dalek Invasion Earth 2150 AD.
Yeah.
I'm still kind of sad we don't have a big screen version of the chase. I think that's something that could have really flew.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of odd that the chase was going to be the thing that they want. I know, because they've no obligation to have done it in order, considering by this point you've already had the Dalek master plan.
Yeah.
Which, like, if you're looking for a Dalek movie, the scale and the scope of that thing, that is a perfect ready-made film for you to, something for you to adapt.
Yeah, but then 14 episodes, big, massive space epic, maybe it's just a budgetary thing. Maybe it's kind of, maybe it'd be easier to do this kind of chase through time and space, you know, in 2 and a bit hours.
Yeah, okay, maybe, yeah, rather than, you know,
I mean,
have a budget and represent.
Arguably, you know, in today's sort of cinema landscape, Dalek Invasion Earth, you could turn that into like 3 films.
Yes, yeah.
You know, you could get a whole franchise out of that.
Okay, yeah, I guess I can see it that way.
And but if anybody's listening and wants to do that, please don't.
But that just shows you the audacity that BBC Doctor Who had. They undertook a massive film where a cinema thing could legitimately, where the home should be, wouldn't even touch it.
And at the end of the day, isn't that kind of what is so great about Doctor Who and why we all love it?
Do you think that added anything to it? Do you think that there was maybe it wasn't so successful because what people were getting from, we'll call it, the prime universe, actual televised black and white Doctor Who, was so much more nourishing than the film that came out?
Possibly. And I think also we've had, you know, by that point they would have had 2 more Dalek stories since the one that's being presented on the big screen. But I suppose they would have done when the Doctor Who and the Daleks came out. So I don't know. I think it is rooted though in that. I think yeah, the fact that Dalek mania had been on the wane is not to be underestimated, but I do think there's a larger societal and cultural reason why the film didn't take off as well as the first one. You know, I think as much as being about films tangentially linked to Doctor Who, I think this podcast might be quite an interesting little look at British cinema throughout the ages as well.
Yeah, because there's Doctor Who.
Is the story of television.
Yeah.
Essentially, Doctor Who is the history of television.
These actors also appear in that great larger story, the story of cinema.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
I think as mission statements go, I think that's a pretty good one. So, coming attractions.
Yeah.
See, do you see how I've amended the next time thing from other time last to a more film-based language? It's clever, right?
He knows what he wants.
So, coming attractions, I suppose it is. I think we'll do what I originally intended to launch this podcast with. And it'll probably be a bit more... So, if you're listening to this expecting a more of a film podcast, we will do one. Mm-hmm. This has obviously been a bit of a mix of both.
This is our... figuratively and literal Dalek.
This is like this is like the crossover episode, this is like the opening of Deep Space Nine where Picard turns up.
Yeah.
Now they're like, oh Christ, they're talking about Star Trek now. Yeah. I just can't.
So this is Quark waving goodbye to Voyager.
This is us handing over. So next time I think we will discuss The Sporting Life. So we'll get to talk a bit more about the free cinema movement and the brave new world for British cinema that was sadly not to be.
Yeah.
And also William Hartnell.
Yeah.
And the role that got him the role of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And then after that, I think we're going to do a series of kind of linked episodes and linked films. And the link's going to be films where two or more doctors have featured together.
Not many instances
not many.
Of that. There's only two
many.
That I can think of.
So there's Will Any Gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Jude.
Yes.
Of course. The Michael Winterbottom film. So Will Any Gentleman, William Hartnell and John Pertwee.
Sure.
Jude, David Tennant and Christopher Eccleston.
Yes.
We've also, with Neil and I, we're stretching it slightly.
Yes.
With Neil and I counts.
Yes, yeah.
Paul McGann, Richard E. Grant.
Yeah.
And there is a Hammer film, I think, where Peter Cushing and Patrick Troughton appear together.
Okay.
I think it's... Is it Blood on Satan's Claw, or is it... I can't remember, but we'll track that down and we'll
sure.
watch that as well. And as where possible, we will watch them in cinema.
Yes.
We'll retire to a drink
suits
again.
Me. It's,
and we will just... Because, we should watch them...
As they were intended.
As they were intended, on a big screen.
If people have taken the time and the effort, the blood and the guts to make for a particular viewing experience,
then we should honour that experience.
Well, exactly.
So, I hope you've enjoyed this little crossover alternate universe. Certainly enjoyed it. But, however you want to put this into On the Time Lash continuity, that's your... that's your prerogative. Join us next time for a lovely discussion about this sporting life.
Yeah, it'll be great.
And if you're interested in, I suppose, On the Time Lash, our next episode after this will be, we open the Matt Smith era.
Yeah.
With a look at The 11th Hour and Spearhead from Space. So if you have a passing interest in Doctor Who and you like Matt Smith, listen to that. It'll be like this. Fun.
Yeah, we basically got the concept of pissed up opinionated men.
Yeah, we've got that down pat.
We own that. That's the hat that we're wearing.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody else in the internet has pissed up.
If only they had though, the internet would be a friendlier place.
Oh, wouldn't it? Anyway, until next we meet.
Thank you very much
for
joining
us. Thanks very much.